It's Wednesday, August the 5th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Today, John Hume's funeral takes place in his native Derry, and in the 2 days since his death, Hume has been the subject of many, many thousands of words about his life, his political career, and his extraordinary legacy. Today, we wanted to look at some facets of a man who many regard as the most consequential Irish political figure of the last 50 years, at least. And to do that, I'm joined by Claire Hanna, the SDLP MP for South Belfast. Claire, thanks for joining us before you head off to the funeral this morning.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
I'd like to go into some detail of the history, the extraordinary history of John Hume in a little while, but maybe could you tell me about what, if any, personal relationship or memories you have of him? You would have been, I'm right in saying, a teenager around that time of the peace process and the leading up to the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah, just about that age, just a couple of months too young to vote in the agreement. But I mean, I grew up in a fairly political family. My dad had worked for the party in the 80s, and my mum in the mid 90s was an elected representative. So I suppose Hume would have been, around and in and out, and I would have met him. But I suppose it's his concepts and ideas that would have loomed fairly large. Although I think the TV show Derry Girls got it just right about how much he was in people's consciousness, with the auntie saying that, God, John Hume's always going on about peace. I hope it works out for him. And I think, you know, that shows kind of how live he was, even in people who weren't particularly engaged in politics, because he spoke so directly to people and because he was such a consistent presence and so consistent in his message. But yeah, I mean, remember him personally. It's the one thing I do always remember. Every time he would see my parents at conference and stuff, he would always say to my mum, "Oh, you're not still with that old fella, are you?" You know, that was his kind of running joke. And he was. I mean, he was. A serious person, because I think he for decades wore the responsibility of what he was trying to achieve very, very heavily, and he thought very deeply about how he would bring people along and how he would solve the challenges. But I think it's no secret that he also enjoyed the crack, enjoyed a drink, enjoyed a sing song, and did so at SDLP events until very recent years.
And just going all the way back, really, I was reading some pieces that we ran in a supplement in the Irish Times yesterday on Tuesday, a piece by my colleague Michael Viney, who many, many years ago, 55 or more years ago, was sent up to Northern Ireland by the then editor, Douglas Gageby, to do a series of reports on what was happening politically in the North at the time. And John Hume was one of the people he talked to. And as a result of that, John Hume wrote a few pieces for the Irish Times, one of which we republished yesterday. It's a really fascinating piece. It's a kind of snapshot of a time a long, long time ago, before the Troubles had started, before the civil rights movement had started. And he gives voice to a sense of dissatisfaction with a new, younger generation of people from a nationalist Catholic background. He himself came from a poor working class background in Derry. He was a grammar school boy, had become a teacher, and he had a series of ideas about what it could and should and might mean to be a nationalist in the North, which went against the grain of the received wisdom at the time.
He did. I mean, because he did those things simultaneously. He did recast nationalism, and of course, you know, physical force and romanticism in Irish nationalism was kind of the dominant ideology. And he transformed nationalist thinking for the whole of the island about how Irish unity would be achieved and about what it meant, and you know how it wasn't, as he said so many times, about, uniting the land. It was about uniting the people. But he rooted it in the practical, in the well-being of people. And I think that's why, when it came to civil rights and when it came to his elected time, people trusted him because, as you say, I mean, he started the credit union with others, just with small change, basically about giving access to resources to the very, very poor families like those he came from. He was always about positive change in people's lives. You know, in the civil rights, he focused very extensively, yes, on the political structures and on tackling gerrymandering, but about allocation of housing as well. And he did that throughout his life. It wasn't about the kind of, you know, ethereal concepts of, it was about what the political failure was doing to people's life chances and to victims, and about, you know, what we could achieve. And that's relevant right up to the present day, where we still obsess a little bit, you know, about the processes of, for example, Irish Unity, rather than, you know, the ends, what it might achieve. But I mean, clearly he was a prolific writer, particularly before he had an established political platform. But that's one of the really interesting things about him. While he was, you know, a member of parliament and a member of the European Parliament, and of course a party leader, he really led far beyond his authority. And even before he achieved either of those roles, you know, he was injecting ideas and thinking into discussion, and of course things that over the decades everybody would eventually get on board with.
How important is Derry in that, I wonder? I mean, I think you're a representative now for Belfast, two very different cities. Derry famously was horrendously gerrymandered in the 1960s when he began his political career, but it was ultimately a majority nationalist city on the border. There was the possibility for real political change and getting, you know, some sense of a handle on political power in Derry. And I just wonder how much that informed both the idea of the possibility of politics as a nationalist in Northern Ireland, and also a sense of a greater scope, maybe, for generosity, for want of a better word.
Yeah, I mean, he was Derry to the core, and Derry was him. And I think, you know, he is first and foremost belongs to Derry. And I suppose that, yeah, very much the political context of the time, because it was, you know, chronic poverty, but not an accident, as poverty rarely is. But it was particularly politically egregious. And so he saw the two things in tandem. Yes, there are different dynamics, Derry being so majority nationalist, but yet being so underrepresented in Hume's time. It is a different dynamic to say, for example, Seamus Mallon, who grew up in a majority unionist town and Protestant town. And I suppose both of those things do shape your thinking. And I suppose that's why he came from nationalism. But really, everything that he said about addressing poverty and you know, material well-being in people's lives, but also about accommodation, you know, and about reaching agreement, and about the political structures, it's absolutely universal, not just for all of Northern Ireland and all of Ireland, but as we know, it can be applied elsewhere as well. But really, Derry was particularly under the caution and particularly under-resourced. And I think one of the other campaigns he was associated with, which still hasn't come to fruition, was a university, a proper university for Derry. And yes, I think he had reason to believe that the underinvestment in Derry was strategic and systemic. And I think that's something that motivated him very greatly. But that's not to say he's any less relevant in the minds of those of us in Belfast or anywhere else on the island.
Now, the party he founded, your party, the SDLP, I think it was founded almost exactly 50 years ago now, co-founded along with the likes of, you know, Gerry Fitt and Paddy Devlin. Like any political party, it was a sort of a coalition, and it brought together those social democratic elements who might have been in a Labour Party or a you know, social democrat party in another country, with some of the strands of traditional nationalism as well. How has that party changed over the years? You know, at times it has been accused of being too green, at times it's been accused of being too much of a Labour Party. How much of its narrative goes to Hume, or how much of it goes to Fitt or to Devlin or those other strands?
Well, it was a broad church, and it is a broad church, and those criticisms about it being to this or to that have been with it for 50 years, because you know, its representative base, the people who elect SDLP representatives are broad in their politics as well. And of course, people can think two things at the same time. You know, you can seek to achieve Irish unity by consent, and you can also be extremely focused on the economic and practical well well-being of people and their public services. Hume shapes it to this day. He's not in any way a contested figure within the SDLP, it's fair to say. And I think that's the beauty of all that he said. It's not, these aren't, you know, rocket science concepts, just about difference being the essence of humanity, about the fact that you cannot eat a flag. You know, those are things that I believe every SDLP elected representative and activist and voter it buys into very, very substantially. And I mean, it's difficult in a devolved context, and where devolution isn't even that stable, to, I suppose, be as much of a practicing social democrat as many of us would want to be, because we simply don't have all the levers, and we don't have all the portions of power. But I think you know, that would be the dominant philosophy within people. But it is also worth saying that Hume, even though he came from a very much majority nationalist city, he believed very strongly in Irish nationalism. He and the others with whom he founded the SDLP deliberately didn't found the Republican Party or the Nationalist Party. They chose to found the Social Democratic and Labour Party, and they chose to locate it very much in the European social democratic mainstream. And of course, working with other left and centre-left political people in Europe through the Party of European Socialists was a really, really big part of his mission and his drive. And he drew, you know, got real inspiration from those other parties and those other political leaders. And many of us, you know, share that inspiration and take it from him. But he could have founded the Nationalist Party. He could have founded the Republican Party, and he could have made it very successful. But he was a Social Democrat because he knew that nationalism or unionism alone aren't going to put bread on anybody's table, and they aren't going to solve the problems that we have or anybody else has.
I mean, the first real manifestation of Hume's thinking in physical form was the power sharing administration in 1973, Sunningdale, which was ultimately brought down by the Loyalist workers' strike, essentially a form of a coup d'etat in Northern Ireland. There was criticism within the SDLP of Hume's insistence on a Council of Ireland. All these patterns, which we can see again and again, is thinking as we move through, you know, the Anglo-Irish Agreement in the 1980s and ultimately the peace process in the 1990s, that he wanted an All-Ireland element, in his view, was essential. But some within the SDLP thought that that was the element that pushed unionism and Brian Faulkner and the Ulster Unionist Party too far, and actually sowed the seeds of the destruction of that. What do you think of that?
I think it just shows his vision. He showed that he knew, and what we now know was the strands in terms of the different sets of relationships. He knew that it wasn't an internal Northern Irish issue. He knew that it wasn't just an internal Ireland North and South issue. You know, that it had to have the third strand as well with Britain and Ireland. And I don't know how. I mean, I think it's gradualism or big vision. I don't think there was a massive divergence in opinion. I don't think people thought it was a bad idea. I suppose it was just in terms of what could be achieved, and we have to remember just how bleak the landscape was, just how intransigent their political opponents were, and because, you know, Hume speak and Hume's concepts seem so obvious now, because everybody right down to the DUP are bought into them. You know, they seem obvious and simple now, but they really, really weren't, and he had to persuade people, and while I don't have chapter and verse of that particular divergence, I don't think anybody disagreed with him that was a fundamental element. I suppose it was just about what could be achieved. And of course, you know, perhaps my reading of history isn't as detailed as it could be. I don't think it was the All-Ireland dimension that brought it down. There were very, very many other factors. There were quite simply those in unionism who didn't want to share power in any way. And there were those in violent republicanism who didn't want any engagement anyway. So it probably, you know, while it might be written that was the straw that broke the camel's back, I don't think it was.
I mean, the grimmest and bleakest decades were the decades of the 1970s and the 1980s. And a lot of that must have been very lonely times for him. One of the things that strikes me looking at his, you know, his life and his career is that a lot of the other protagonists were at least operating from within the safety of their own base camps, so to speak, surrounded by their supporters. He was subject to attack from all sides at one point or another, or sometimes simultaneously, whether it be from unionists who didn't trust him, from Republicans who talked to describe the SDLP as stoops, you know, who from all sides, essentially. And then in the background, you have this constant low hum of this awful violence and regular tragedies going on. It must have taken a toll. And even looking at photographs of him over the years, you could kind of see that it took a toll.
I just think that was so clear, you know, in everything that he's done, but even in a lot of what you were saying yesterday, the sheer tenacity and strength of spirit to just go through those cycles and I suppose to know, as he clearly did, what the solutions were, and for other people to be so pigheaded, I suppose. And yes, it would have been very lonely. It was clear from footage, and it's clear from the things that he said, he felt very deeply the pain that people were feeling. He cried with victims. It wasn't just a concept, and I suspect it wasn't something he could just put away. And quite clearly, it was his 24/7. You know, there was no escape from the work that he had to do. And yeah, it did. I think it wore very heavily on him, and I'm sure on his whole family. And I know Pat, his wife's contribution, it will never be written out of the story either, because it was so fundamental. And it's clear anybody who speaks to her, she wasn't, you know, just you know, his wife. She was his closest political advisor, and kind of walked all of that with him. But yeah, I mean, it really he had the weight of expectation of those who did want to end it. You know, knew he was their man. He was the person who had the answers. But yeah, imagine that happening for 25 years, and those who could have put a stop to it not doing that alone would kill you. Let alone, I suppose, you know, just the relentless awfulness. But it just shows an unbelievable human spirit, love for your fellow man, and tenacity. That, I mean, really, I can't think of another person who's demonstrated that over such a long period of time.
And did he find a way? Was one of the things that helped him to find a way through that an ability to rise to the international stage? I mean, I think certainly he's the only real international statesman who emerged out of the Northern conflict, and he had a position of influence, and he had the ears of the most powerful people in Brussels and in Washington and various other places. And he had an intellectual gravitas, a sort of a depth. I mean, partly because he was part of that kind of extraordinary generation, the generation of Heaney and Friel, a kind of a, you know, an explosion of intellectual creativity as well. Would that be part of what sort of sustained him through all that? Because you do wonder sometimes, there must have been times in the late 80s, early 90s, where he just thought he'd jack it all in.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, when you see there's footage of interviews with him and kind of reading that, I suppose we call it imposter syndrome now, you know, that he probably couldn't believe that this, you know, young man from Derry had this access. But it was that fundamental thing that he knew, that, you know, he said, if there's a big problem, make it bigger. And he always was aware that it wasn't going to be solved just in Derry. It wasn't going to be solved just in Northern Ireland or on the island of Ireland, and that he had to bring his influence to bear. And I suppose, again, when you're not, sloshed around by the daily horror and by the sniping and the jibing, really the solutions are, to many external people, not very, very simple, but I suppose easier to draw. And goodness, aren't we lucky that he did it? Because that's the other thing that's really hard. It's easy to forget that success wasn't a given. You know, I think because we're looking at it from 2020, it seems that of course this is how it happened. But just as you say, how many times he must have thought of jacking it all in, that if it didn't work this time, God, when is it going to work? But I suppose he said so many times, the fundamental problem hasn't changed. And so the solution hasn't changed. And probably you would imagine he was encouraged and galvanized by the response that he did get and the buy-in that he did get for global leaders. And of course, he did the, you know, the US strand, which was very much about leveraging US political interests to put pressure on you know, UK and Dublin policy. But of course, he was a committed European and used that leverage to bring resources and funds. He said many times that the best peace process is a job. You know, he kind of always had those two twin strategies.
But it's interesting then that he had developed these relationships with, you know, senior civil servants in Dublin, major political figures on Capitol Hill in Washington and in Brussels as well. And then he moved to take this, what certainly seemed at the time to be an enormous risk, which was, I mean, he was seen as that he was the face of constitutional nationalism and therefore opposed to physical force republicanism. And yet he was the one who reached out to Republicans. I was interested to hear you saying in a podcast the other day that, you know, you weren't an adult at the time, but had you been, you probably would have opposed that at the outset.
Yeah, I think I would. I think I'm self-aware enough to know, you know, that I wouldn't have got it all right. And I suppose he was visionary. He saw where it could go. And I suppose he saw that nothing else had worked. And we know to this day, there is still a cult of violence in Irish nationalism and in Irish politics. And he had to excise that. And he knew that if there were still those forces pretending and seducing, that there was another way to do this, that you could, you know, maim and kill your way to Irish unity. If he didn't bring that strand of thought along, that it would keep bubbling up. And I think that would have been very, very difficult because, you know, they're still on a day and daily basis, you know, atrocities were still happening. But I suppose he knew, while a lot of other people would play into kind of base responses and kind of human instinct to kind of, I suppose, gain revenge and so on, he understood people's thinking. I think he understood where those who were getting absorbed into violence on the various side, he understood where they were coming from while never giving them cover. But yeah, I think that would have been really, really difficult to take. And of course, he necessarily had to be secretive about it as well. So I suppose people wouldn't have necessarily had a chapter and verse on his thinking. But clearly, we know the IRA and the British Army, essentially, you know, obviously with other forces involved there, were in a stalemate. Neither of them was going to win militarily, but neither of them were going to accept it. And I think he could have, you know, not got his hands dirty and allowed that to rumble on for how many more years? How long would it have taken them to realise it themselves? But he knew he had to intervene. And you know, we know that for every year that the killing stopped, how many lives did it save? And I suppose he also knew that the bitterness and the cynicism and just the brutality and cruelty of this thing rumbling on for so many years was making reconciliation harder and harder and harder. And the longer you left it, the less likely it would be possible. And it, again, it's hard to think of the counterfactual, but if he hadn't done it, Northern Ireland could really have descended. It would have, and it would have polluted the whole of the island. You know, it all political dynamics would have been sucked into it. So I suppose he knew that nothing else was working.
I mean, it's a measure of his success, as it is of any successful politician, that you and I and all of us live in a world which John Hume made. I mean, and that all the tortuous negotiations that took place through the 1990s and into the 2000s and the Good Friday Agreement and the St. Andrews Agreement and all those things, they ultimately ended up with a political shape and a political dispensation, which was clearly visible in what John Hume had been talking about 30 years or more previously. So they're his institutions more than they are anybody else's institutions. And I do wonder sometimes, looking at them, the very complex interlocking sort of machinery, you know, of within Northern Ireland, on the island as a whole, between Britain and Ireland, in the broader European context. They're the product of a sophisticated and subtle mind. But operating within them is not necessarily a very sophisticated and subtle politics. And a lot of those elements of the machine seem to me to be perhaps not even working at all, or certainly not working as he might have hoped them to work.
Well, I suppose you can, you know, he believed that those were the ways to, you know, achieve reconciliation and achieve agreement and achieve consent. So you can, there's two, I suppose, ways to approach it. You can power share because you believe it's the right thing to do, or you can power share because it's the law and those are the structures and you have to operate within them, and people can draw their own conclusions about you know, where people fit into those two lists. So in some ways, I mean, it should evolve. We should be, I imagine he wouldn't have thought that 20 years after he finally got the structures through we would still require it, and I suppose if people were more bought in to his concepts, we wouldn't, 50 years after he had the idea, still be living within those structures. But it is until people, I suppose, really take on board those values. And that's the encouraging thing about these few days, that people aren't just talking about, you know, he was born here and he did this. You know, they are really thinking about what he taught us, I suppose. But until people learn those things, that, you know, there's no meaningful progress until everybody's round the table, until all strands of political thought are represented, until people know that victories aren't solutions, you know, just winning isn't actually, you know, furthering anything, then we are probably destined to still need the ugly scaffolding, as Mark Durkin put it. I wish we didn't need it 50 years on. I hope we won't in another 50. But I suppose it's until people embed the concepts and don't just, you know, follow the law on the structures, we probably won't get that much further.
Speaking of Mark Durkin, I was watching him on RTE television last night, and he was asked whether the decline of the SDLP or its replacement by Sinn Féin as the main nationalist party in Northern Ireland was an inevitable part of the process that John Hume set in train in the 1990s. He said he thought the word inevitable should never be used in politics, but it did seem to be one of the things that Hume accepted might be an outcome of this process, didn't it? That his own party might decline ultimately in influence and size.
Well, I think he probably knew that, you know, if everybody went to where he was trying to take them, he would lose the unique selling point of his party. But of course, he was not. He was about ending the conflict. He was about creating the structures, and he wasn't, for better or for worse, he wasn't about building a political machine. So there's a lot of things that the SDLP did wrong, it's not something I haven't said before. I mean, that we didn't focus, and we haven't always focused as much on the organisation and I suppose building our own structures. But that was because Hume was off, you know, doing the work and kind of creating the bigger part of the framework. So yes, in some ways it was inevitable. In some ways, it was you know, others were better resourced and more professional. And I suppose in some ways it was the structures as well, what people think you know, are valuable attributes. Once you get into the nitty gritty of you know, power sharing and governance, I think and you can see there's a codependency between the two large parties that's very, very visible in their election results, and I suppose in their behaviour in the structure. So Mark is right. That's a very Mark Durkin answer, that nothing is inevitable in politics. But I suppose you know, there are things the SDLP could have done better to guard against that, you know, to build its own political infrastructure and to succession plan better, etc., etc. But they were in the business of achieving an end to a conflict that nobody had achieved an end to for hundreds and hundreds of years. So in that regard, he was just immensely successful. And I don't think, you know, John Hume should carry the can for some of those structural things. You know, in many ways, he has been the most successful political leader. He did what he set out to do.
Going back to that article in 1964 in the Irish Times, what do you think that John Hume, or John Hume when he was well enough to address these sort of issues, would have thought of your party's current relationship with Fianna Fáil? Because I know that's something that you're not a great fan of. I mean, Do you think he might have seen that as regressive?
I think John Hume, when he set up and others set up the party, they knew how important it was for the SDLP to be the common ground in Irish politics and for reconciliation, you know, never to be a political football. And I suppose to keep strong relationships. You spoke about the relationships he had with, you know, officials in foreign affairs and so on. And I think that's something that would have been important. But I think he also would have been hurt and frustrated about the doldrums that the SDLP were in, and he would have felt the powerlessness and the fear of slide of this place into a much worse place that the SDLP and a lot of people were experiencing in 2017, 2018, 2019, which was of course the loss of the Good Friday's institutions, which was a hard Brexit coming down the line, which was, I suppose, no representation in Westminster and no voice and no real forums through which people could achieve their political goals, and the frustration and the hopelessness that was breeding in communities and particularly in the SDLP family. So he was somebody who was always trying to find a way out. So it's not for me to say what way he would have found out of, you know, worked his way out of that particular situation. But I do know he valued political relationships across the board, and I do know he very much valued the Social Democratic family and that set of relationships.
Claire Hannah, thanks very much indeed for joining us today. And that's it for today's podcast. Thanks to Claire for joining us and also to our producer, Declan Conlon. Before we go, I would like to encourage you yet again, if you haven't already done so, please do go to irishtimes.com/subscribe, where you can sign up for unlimited access to the Irish Times for the introductory price of just €1 for the first month. So try it for a month anyway. And if you want to get in touch with us, we would be delighted to hear from you. Just email us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. But until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.